Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, here to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, where we feature only writers who are or have been residents of our great San Joaquin Valley. Two stories tonight. First, Valley Song by Stephen Gutierrez, followed by The Branch Office from Hell by Charlie Warnes. So now here to get us started is Stephen Gutierrez, reading a story of his entitled Valley Song.
Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, mi amor fea, sucia, so naughty and nice. I whisper your secret name in your ear. I shout it out loud. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, that's right, you. I remember when I rode the hound all the way from Los Angeles to Chico in my college years. The bus driver announcing over the speaker up and down the valley, Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, next stop in 20 minutes. Some godforsaken town coming up on the side of the road, tumbleweeds and two old men on the curb chewing away, gums pink and rotten. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, belted out from up front. It's stuck in my mind all these years. A refrain on wheels, a sweet call traveling north up Highway 99 and zigzagging across the valley floor on schedule. A brazen voice alerting the poor and tattered peons of all stripes. Mexicans, blacks and whites so beaten they seemed one. Gathering their things in the rocky aisle before stopping in front of another Greyhound bus station so lonely it seemed a rebuke to existence. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, next stop in. Out the window another town passed. A simple strip of commerce with two auto shops and a bar anchoring it. I rolled on. Day turned into night. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton. I pressed my face against the green-tinted window. Saw you in all your glorious raiment. Fresno, coming up right here. 10-minute break. Fresno, you jeweled whore, you. Gazing at me directly from a sheltered street corner. With your raisin necklace wrapped around your withered old crone's neck. Blonde head, darkly Asian eyes, Mexican teeth. Fresno, 10-minute break. So ripe and alluring, so appealing. Esa Fresno, what are you doing outdoors on a cold, foggy night? Get inside and warm your toes before a blazing fire. Assume your throne. Take on your full title. Let a plebeian troubadour salute you in song. Become the whole valley for those who listen and take his jibes in stride. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, you are queen of the valley towns. You've ascended the throne with style. I crown you everlastingly with pomegranate seeds, you body empress, you. I place them on your head and snicker, bow low and grin. Don't take me seriously. I'm only the errand boy. You're too big for me, with your rouged cheeks, loud ways, rough moods. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, I hear you laughing down the hall at the IRS. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, you haven't washed your underwear in months. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, you wear girdles that hide your fat. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, you ride motorcycles that pollute the town. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, your lowriders are out of date. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, I loved you still. I really did. Everything about you turned me on. Your dry canal and your broad boulevard needing a facelift. Blackstone, bereft of beauty, read a caption under a picture of the main drag looking pretty shabby. And the wife and I laughed. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, we were living in hell. Where are we? We asked each other. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, I answered for us both. The love grew strong. The charms came on. I started to sing a song about you, Fresno, Modesto, Stockton. Your modest neighborhoods and neon-lit streets inviting a comparison to any neon-lit American street where sadness and dark cocktail lounges reign, only sadder, only wrecked. Your ivy-walled cemeteries housing the poets wanting to rise, missing this dear place. Ernesto Trejo, Omar Salinas, Chuck Moulton, all of them eaten up by Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, all of them with a connection to the town I sing, haphazardly, not knowing what I'm doing, really, but wanting to say, Fresno, Modesto Stockton, one more time before I say it again. Fresno, Modesto Stockton. Your brick red junior college taking up a corner busy with traffic, so beautiful and grand. Your broad-leafed alleys invited a midday walk. Your depopulated zoo and your popular Kmart and your many places of crappy part-time work holding too many characters to name. Lupe and Sandra, Joe and Ronnie, Elwood and Marty, where would I stop? Your rainy streets and your sad empty malls. Your bars at the side of the road. Your parks and your cons shooting up under the trees next to the trash cans. Your desperate put-on face. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton. I got a tale for you. Sure and simple. It takes place at the Southeast Fresno Boxing Club in the heart of Southeast Fresno. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton. Here's a fight for the ages. It starts with me stepping into the ring and a guy named Chicken Scrap Joe after me. We came in on the same side, ducking through the ropes, flexed shoulders and rolled heads the way boxers do, pretending we were boxers, and we were. Touched gloves and eased into it at the bell. We both wore long gym shorts and pliable shoes made for the ring, T-shirts with insignias denoting our interest. Me a bookstore and he a Harley dealership, and red gloves taped at the wrist. We moved stealthily. Come on, Joe. Come on, you cowardly bastard. Make a move. Throw a punch. Aquí estoy. Aquí te espero. I coached myself. I watched his every move. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton. It gets heavy. I named him Chicken Scrap Joe because he was just that. Chicken Scrap. But his real name was Jose, and he was brawny and fierce, and I stopped him mid-ring as he was pressing me. I caught him with a good one. I skipped back to the neutral corner as he lay sprawled on the canvas. My God, I think I've killed the son of a... I told myself, not so happily. Okay, box, spat out the trainer in the corner. I did that. I spent the next round with my second, spiky-haired Humberto, leading me around the ring from the apron, with little twirling motions of his fingers behind Jose's head. Jose's eyes glazed, intent, his left glove quivering at his chin and his right cocked at his ear. I popped him twice before the bell rang to end it all, and we collapsed in each other's arms, exhausted. You caught me, Jose, he said. Yeah, you gave me a few good blows, I said. You're all right, man, when you relax, he said, huffing and puffing, composing himself, blowing the snot out onto his glove. Trying to look relaxed, appear calm, unshaken, his eyes still glazed. And the guys walked around the gym to their stations, twirling their hands, ready to spar, shadow box, get down in the bag, anything to loosen up and calm the nerves. Otherwise you get too wild, he finished, pawing himself. We had our hands on the apron and were talking, slump-shouldered, with deep breaths. Already two guys were in there sparring, and the buzzer was busy signaling the end of a new round. Yeah, I'm all right, man. It's a hard sport, I said, not knowing what I was talking about, a little shaken up myself. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, you came at me with two fists lowered and I responded. I dropped the man in the ring. He had been taking advantage of my easiness, inviting me to spar with a big innocent smile, and then, once in the ring, unloading on me. Dudes took me aside and said, don't let him take advantage of you, eh? He's using you. Throw some leather. That's what we're here for. Orale. I climbed in there ready to go. You got a good ride, eh? Use it. I did. But first I felt him out, circling him slowly in that preliminary round. I threw tentative jabs. At the 10-second buzzer, I stiffened up and caught him twice, hard, on the head. He smiled at me, and I smiled back. Good round. Stood in my corner with my second urging me to breathe and giving me a taste of water. I sucked at the tube and turned around to face the beast again. Jose the biker, Chicken Scrap Joe, pounded his gloves together and approached in a crouch. He was big at the shoulders, slow-footed, mean. He was ready to bore into me. Come on, I told myself. Show him what you got this time. The night was warm and beautiful. The door was open in early spring. The softball team's chattering outside, and the rucas walking in and out, checking up on the guys. They sat cross-legged, flashing a bit of panties before stretching their miniskirts down in the bleachers. And curly-haired Sonia even winked at me, giving me a bit of inspiration before she turned to her friend with the baby, picking up her own from the floor. That's the way it was in Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, Simone. And I danced across the ring unafraid. Already I knew a little bit about boxing. I picked it up all the time, glove knowledge. It was impossible not to. Leaning back on the ropes with some vato from Kerman throwing leather at my gut and then up at my head. Spinning away and leaving him with a little something to remember me by in Fresno, Modesto, Stockton. A short flurry saving me when I didn't know I had it in me. I did now. I had it in me. I returned the next night for my next lesson, and in between, prayed to the god of leather, on my knees, to keep me safe as I learned more about the sport that intrigued me. Take care of me in the ring, O God above, take care of me in the ring. I sure meant it. It was brutal in there, in the ring, potentially tragic. Get in there with the wrong guy and I'm hurt forever in Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, no lie. I end up walking with a limp and shaking a cup for the viejitas on Belmont. Oh, please, please, please take care of me. I pleaded, and I got answered. Round two started. Jose and I began to fight. He moved across from me, slowly, sluggishly, but ready to nail me with that hammery left hook. It was my fault for letting him use it, but no more. I was ready to throw blows. I was ready to catch him, and I did. Just as he lowered his left to unleash that fearsome punch, my right came across so cleanly and meanly it's probably recorded in the annals of boxing, the unwritten book, and found its target. It goes like this, in slow motion. The shoulder lowers, the glove drops below the chin to wing up at my head, and in that moment, the chin exposed, without premeditation or plan, the opportunity present, instinct activated, I throw the punch and catch him, bingo, on the chin. It's a straight right cross from hell. God's garden shivers with delight. All creation takes note. It twists his head to the side. He smiles weirdly at me. He lurches forward as if to hold me and drops straight on his face. Then he turns on his back and breathes heavily. Take 10! Take 15! Nestor Chacon, aged boxer serving as resident trainer of the Southeast Fresno Boxing Club, an official man in charge of the gym, yells from the corner where he is sitting at a table wrapping hands. But Joe gets up, wobbles to his corner after the round, and the fight is over. Chicken Scrap Joe is done. He cannot terrorize me anymore. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, that's the way it went. He gives me a final kudos at the apron and we part friends, sliding by each other sweatily, smilingly. But the best happened before. While I was standing in the ring, watching Jose breathe heavily on his back, I glanced outside the ropes and saw a man, a Mexican man, working with his prospect from Huron, the tough farming community up the road, give me the nod, the slight nod as he held the mitts. I nodded back and wiped my brow. Jose struggled up, and I came out to meet him for the rest of the round. I boxed him well, a little mercifully, but on my toes for his big punch coming at me if I gave him a chance. I didn't give him a chance. It has stayed with me after all these years. It has fortified me. Through ups and downs of my personal life and my writing career, I remember it. Nothing more weighty than a slight nod cast my way, in my direction, in the middle of an insignificant sparring session in the big gray gym at Southeast Park in Fresno sometime in the late 80s. But I will take that nod over all the encomiums the writing world has to offer. I will choose it over its paltry awards and citations. It means more to me. It said, boxeador. It said, campeón. It said, Crazy mother, it said. Idiot, it said. Hijo de la chingada. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, y que. I made my way out of the gym, noticing the respect I had earned by the clean path opening for me. It led to the heavy bags hanging from the rafters like sturdy black pillows ready to be softened up. I cooled down with a few rounds, easy and slow, digging in soft hooks and uppercuts and trying to keep my balance with my forehead resting on the bag. Very tired, I pushed the bag away when it swung toward me and worked it. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, está bien. I stepped out into the night air, all the lights bright outside, knowing this chapter in my life had ended. A certainty lodged within me concerning boxing, a deep belief that it had been played out for now, and a general sense of amazement came next. All my fears about my involvement here at the Southeast Fresno Boxing Club had evaporated in my grander quest to know something about myself. All it had taken was a little courage, simple courage, in stepping forward. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton, get down.
Stands a boxer and a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down or cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, I am leaving, I am leaving, but the fighter still remains. Lie-la-lie.
That was our author tonight, Stephen Gutierrez, reading a story of his entitled Valley Song. Stephen is originally from Los Angeles, but lived in the Valley from 1986 to 1992, at which time he taught at Fresno City College. In its entirety, this story is about a boxer with a Mexican-American background who, being who he is, tells us about his life, his views on things, and his impression of what it's like for a man like him to live and work mainly in the North Valley. Fresno, Modesto, Stockton is the phrase we hear repeatedly. As a tough young man, he has this gigantic compulsion to prove himself by becoming a boxer. We learned all about what it's like to work out with other aspiring boxers in places like the Southeast Fresno Boxing Club. Somehow he gets matched up with a guy who looks like he's going to mop the floor up with him. But by using that deadly right cross of his, he's able to beat his opponent and by the end of the story really celebrate the fact that he can once again feel good about himself. Thank you, Stephen Gutierrez, for such a great insight into the character of your protagonist. Folks, Stephen Gutierrez is currently a professor of English and the director of the Creative Writing Department at the California State University in Hayward, California. Along with numerous stories in major literary magazines, anthologies, and newspapers, Stephen is the author of two award-winning books, Elements, a collection of short stories, and Live from Fresno y Los. Thank you, Stephen Gutierrez, for your story tonight. We hope you send us more of your work in seasons to come. And now for our second story. It's written by Charlie Warnes and is entitled The Branch Office from Hell. Here's the author, Charlie Warnes, to read it for us. The Branch Office from Hell.
The Branch Office from Hell. I just finished college, class of 49, and got a job with Peterson Adjusting Company. The pay was just so-so, but after 8 short weeks of training, I'd be a full-fledged insurance claim adjuster, with a company car to boot. Now, the job did have one drawback. It was called Fargo. 250 miles up in the Red River Valley. From what I'd heard, Fargo was flatter than a dysentery turd, windier than Chicago, and still somewhere back in the Dark Ages. I thought it was kind of dumb for Peterson to send me up there on a Friday, but I guess they wanted me to get settled on my own time instead of theirs. I was instructed to report to the Fargo office at 8:30 sharp and introduce myself to the district superintendent, a Mr. Gordon Polstad. He would show me the ropes and assign me to a trainer. So, on Monday morning, I was strolling down Broadway toward the office. The street numbers told me that I had to be getting close, but I began to think there must have been some mistake. The only commercial building in sight was a shabby two-story structure with a for-lease sign on the vacant storefront. But this had to be it. The street-level door made an audible protest as I pulled it open. The dim light in the dusty stairwell was filtered through a layer of pigeon crap that coated the skylight. The second floor seemed vacant except for one office near the front. The office decor matched that of the hallway. Remnants of worn and blackened linoleum, chipped wainscoting, and cracked plaster in varying shades of water-stained green. The layout told me it might have been a doctor's office in some past age. The fluorescent light flickered erratically to supplement the morning sunlight from the two dirty windows facing the street. The only person was a heavy-set female creature in a wrinkled flower print dress. She pecked awkwardly at a large black Underwood, making frequent pauses to take a drag on her cigarette that smoldered in the half-filled ashtray. She did not seem to be aware of my presence. I stood there for a moment, assessing my situation, and began to ask myself whether I should stay or bolt and run. I politely cleared my throat to get her attention. My third attempt must have been rather harsh, for she jumped with a start, glared up at me, and responded with, "Hey, what's your problem?" I was already mentally off balance, and after an awkward pause, I finally blurted out, "Why, yes, ma'am, I'm... Ring, ring," went the phone on the adjacent desk. She waddled over and picked it up. "Hello, Peterson Adjusting. What's your problem?" Sounded like this was her standard greeting. "Long distance, you say? Well, no. No, afraid we can't take no collect calls." "Who?" "Oh, him. Yeah, I guess we can take it." "Hello? Afraid you'll have to talk louder. I can't hardly hear you." No, he ain't come in yet." "What? Can you say that again?" "No, but I'll tell him you called." "Yeah, I did give him your message last week." "Andrews? No, he don't work here no more." "Look, we're short-handed here, and besides, we just been swamped by work lately." "Yes, we will get to your claim as soon as we can." "Look, mister, I'm just a secretary here." "Yes, I told you I'd give him the message." "Hey, I don't care who you are. I don't have to take that kind of crap from nobody." She slammed the receiver down, waddled back to her desk, and arranged her buttocks around the tortured clerical chair. Once settled, she gave me an evil grin, showing off a crooked row of decaying teeth. "Damn small-town big shots. The smaller the town, the bigger the heads. Big frog in a small town, that's all he is. Just because he's used to pushing his way around there up at Quisling, Minnesota, he thinks he's a big shot. Betcha if he found himself in some big city like Fargo here, he'd be lost in 5 minutes. She then squinted back at the paper in front of her and pecked out a few more words on the rickety typewriter. I was again entertaining thoughts of escape, and was just about to turn toward the door when she abruptly looked up and said, "Oh, yeah, can I help you with something?" This time I was ready. "Oh, why, yes, ma'am. I have an appointment to meet Mr. Polstad at 8:30. "Oh, well, why didn't you say something? He ain't come in yet. Here, just fill out this here form and have a seat over there. And make sure you print neat. lot of people, they just scribble down the information. Then they bellyache because we can't make head nor tail of what happened. We ain't magicians, you know. Obediently, I began to fill out the form. But when I got down to the third line that asked date of loss, it finally came to me. This dizzy dame thought I was a claimant. Ma'am, I'm not here to file a claim. Mr. Peterson hired me down in St. Paul last week, and I was sent up here to report for work. Oh, so you're the one! Her mood seemed to brighten. Grinning at me through her salt and pepper teeth, she continued, Yeah, they wrote and said you was coming, but I understood them to mean next week. Well, it's just as good you got here today. Boy, we got your work cut out for you. Oh, well, you see, I was only hired last week, and I was to report here for training. Training? Ha! Yeah, that's what they tell a lot of them. Yeah, we give you training, all right, but like Gordon says, there's no training like rolling up your sleeves and getting some experience. Oh, I think I hear Gordon coming now. She craned her neck to look out the window. Yep, that's him, all right. I see his car parked down there. Boy, will he be glad to see you. I soon heard footsteps echoing from the stairwell. Mr. Polstead was a rather trim man, in his 30s, with a Dagwood Bumstead face punctuated by a mustache that somehow just did not seem to fit. My attention was drawn to the dark shadows around his eyes. Both his soiled white shirt and his wrinkled brown suit were a couple sizes too large for him. He was carrying a leather satchel in his left hand and the stub of a cigarette in the yellowed fingers of his right. He paused and made a productive-sounding cough into his cupped right hand. I prepared to introduce myself, but the secretary beat me to it. Oh, morning, Gordon! Glad to see you finally got here. This here's that new guy they sent up from the cities. Oh, good morning, he said as he transferred the smoldering butt to his lips, wiped something onto the right thigh of his trousers, and grabbed my hand. I tried to ignore the residual organisms wiggling around his clammy palm. He squinted at me through the smoke drifting into his right eye and mumbled out of the corner of his mouth, Glad to have you with us. Be with you in a minute. Then to the secretary he said, Okay, what is it you wanted to tell me, Miss Horklequist? Oh, we better go back to your office, she said. Well, so much for my introduction. A mere 15 minutes on the job and I found myself stranded out front in this dingy office. Now, why they went into that back office is beyond me, for with the timbre of their voices, they might as well have been standing right in front of me. Mercer's, they called 20 minutes ago. Garfield, he didn't show up again. Oh, well, that doesn't surprise me none. Then there was a pause, and he blurted out, Damn it, anyway. That's the last straw. Now, if and when that bugger shows up, get his stuff from him and give him his check. I ain't going to put up with some jerk who thinks this is just some part-time job. Believe me, Gordon, I'd love to, but you know I can't do that. I ain't his boss. You're the one who's got to do it. Yeah, I guess you're right. Well, tell you what. When he shows up, advance him a couple of bucks from petty cash. As long as he's got a little dough, I'll know where I can find him. Okay, but ain't he going to be suspicious? Nah, he ain't smart enough. Now, tell me about this kid out front. Don't know much about him, except he says he's a trainee, so I guess he don't have no experience. Oh, boy, another trainee, eh? What with a bunch of morons that I got to lead around by the hand, plus them other booze fighters, it's no wonder nothing gets done around here. He punctuated this statement with a hacking cough and then continued, So, what's he like?
Don't know much about him, but since you're asking me, he seems kind of strange. I tried like the dickens to talk to him, but all he does is stand around there clearing his throat all the time, and he mumbles a lot. Frankly, Gordon, if you ask me, I don't think he got what it takes.
Great, just great. Another prima donna who can't deal with people. Ah, hell. Send him back here. Might as well see what I can do with him.
Shortly, she waddled out, gave me a phony bright smile, and said, Yeah, Mr. Polstead, he can see you now. Just go right on back.
Now, his office was a rat's nest, with piles of paper and files everywhere. He was well into his second cigarette. He barely glanced up as I entered and said, Yeah, pull up a chair and sit down.
I picked a pile of files from the chair and placed them on my lap. I had to sit at attention,
just to see his face over the mountains of clutter on his desk.
Sorry I couldn't see you earlier, but I had a couple things that just couldn't wait. Well, he said,
lighting a fresh Lucky off the butt end of the one he had going,
tell me about yourself.
Okay, cue call. I commenced to wax eloquently about my education and natural-born gifts, which set the foundation for me to become the ultimate claim adjuster. You know, the standard interviewing line of bull. After a couple of minutes, he picked up a file and began to thumb through it. When he obviously began reading it, I made a courteous pause. He glanced up at me, frowned, and said,
"Go on, go on, go on, I'm listening."
So I resumed and was about to stress a key point when he interrupted.
"Look here, kid. See all these files here? You know why they're here? Well, let me tell you. It's 'cause we got enough work to keep 5 good men busy for the next 6 months, that's what. But they only give me 3. And on top of that, only one of 'em's worth a damn. I don't know what Peterson was telling you when he went and offered you to do this here job, but I need somebody who can get right out there and hustle."
Well, I picked right up on that point. "Well, you're talking to the right man here. Why, as soon as I finish my training, I know I'll be one of your top adjusters in just a matter of a couple of months." He looked at me like I had a pigeon sitting on my head and said,
"Couple of months? Hell, that's what I mean when I said I don't know what Peterson's told you. Training's something you get from experience. Heck, if I trained all of my boys like Peterson thinks it's done, this here pile of paper in front of me would be 6 feet high. I tell you what, you get to ride with me for these next 2 days, and when you do, you better be sharp and pay attention, because on Wednesday you're going to be out there on your own, sink or swim."
I gulped, forced an eager smile, and replied, "Okay, let's get to it." Within the hour, we were on our way to the first call of the day. Me, carrying his heavy satchel, and him jabbering away a mile a minute about insurance and the claim business. That first day was a blur of information, coughing, data, smoke, legal jargon, more coughing and smoke, acronyms, and wheeling and dealing. I'll have to say this for Polstead, though. In spite of his quirks, he could wheel and deal like I'd never seen before, and he could bring the most stiff-necked claimant around in a matter of minutes. True to his promise, on Wednesday morning I was on my own. No graduation, no ceremony, not even Mr. Polstead. Just a stack of files and claim forms, a city map, and a small envelope of bus tokens. I sat down at one of the empty desks to look things over, but incriminating glares from Miss Horklequist told me something was wrong. 15 minutes passed, and she got up and waddled into the back office, closing the door behind her ample rear. She made a phone call. I was able to hear just enough words to get the gist of her message.
"You're still in here?"
All morning. I told you. "Yes, one that wants to sit around the office all day. Won't make it for more than a week." "Yeah, I'll keep an eye."
That conversation may have continued, but I wouldn't know because I was out of there. The job itself turned out to be pretty easy. You see, I'm a pretty quick study. And I also don't let anybody push me around. Oh, there was a few rough spots. And I might have even ruffled a few feathers in the process, but I was getting some cases wrapped up. I stopped by the office on Friday to pick up some more files. And just as I was climbing the stairs, I could hear something going on up in the office. The discussion involved Polstead, Miss Horklequist, and another guy named Raymond.
"Damn it, I tell you, I'm fed up with it. I'm sick and tired of carrying that ball around for you. And when all I get for it is another ration of plain old crap."
"Now just listen here, Raymond. What you handle is peanuts compared to what I do each week, and I got to run this office and train these new boys besides."
Yeah, I heard all that before. And I know how you do it, too. You know, I hear about the way you get all them cases closed, and someday it's going to catch up.
Hey, watch it, Raymond. At least I get them done and closed. That's a heck of a lot more than I can say for you."
I paused before stepping quietly into the doorway. The three of them were behind the counter. Polstead and the blob had their backs to me, and a heavy-set red-haired man was facing them.
"All right, we'll talk about me then," Raymond said. "Look, all I'm asking for is another $20 a month."
Ray, you know you're not up for a raise for another 3 months. And besides, a raise that big just ain't in the guidelines. Hell, you're the highest paid guy we got around here."
"Oh, don't give me that," Polstead. "I already know what Garfield's making, and that's a whole $10 less than they pay over to MAB.
"Now, that's where you're dead wrong, Raymond. You see, Garfield, he don't work here no more."
"Oh, when did he go?"
"Monday was his last day."
"Boy, things I find out when I don't have a gun," Raymond said as a wry smile came over his face. "Well, just who does that leave you with then?"
"Well, we got this new guy here. Real sharp young fellow, just come up here from the cities. As a matter of fact, he's already running circles around you. Why, just in his first week here, he..."
"Just him and me then, eh? Leaves you pretty short-handed then, don't it? Well, let me tell you what, Polstead. I don't really care what your doggone guidelines have to say about the matter. It's $20 a month or I'm walking out that door over there."
"10. It's my final offer."
"Sorry. So long."
"But wait. Peterson's going to be all over my butt for this. But I'll go $12.50.
"Nope. They're going to give me 25 more over to MAB.
"Well, you're making a big mistake. But I guess that's it then. You think you can get everything wrapped up in these next 2 weeks? You still got that thing up there at Quisling to handle, you know."
"Oh, that's your problem, Polstead. I start over to MAB on Monday. And here's the keys to that pile of junk you got sitting on the street out here."
It was then that he glanced at my satchel and realized that I was Polstead's new young Turk. He gave a consenting snort and said,
"Good luck, kid. You're going to need it."
He left the three of us standing there in an awkward silence. Me, deciding that the best tact was to play dumb, and them, gaping at me and wondering just how much I might have overheard. Before long, Miss Horklequist folded her massive buttocks around her clerical chair, lit a cigarette, and began typing in earnest. A few more awkward seconds passed before Polstead forced a strange smile on his face and said with all the charm he could muster,
"Well, Buster, glad to see you show up just now. You're just the man I was looking for. I guess you might have heard one of our former employees on your way in." "Ah, don't pay no attention to what you might have heard him saying. He just wasn't working out, you know." "I was having one hell of a time making him get the hang of this business. You can only lead a guy around by the hand so long, you know." "Some of the boys, they just aren't cut out for this work, you know."
"Well, as a matter of fact, I..."
Hey, come on back in my office, boy. Here, have a seat. Oh, Miss Horklequist, get me a couple glasses and some ice from down the hall, will you?"
He slumped down in his chair, opened a lower desk drawer, and pulled out a half-full bottle of Jim Beam.
"You know, Buster, I've been reviewing your work pretty close for these past few weeks now. If I have to say so myself, you're catching on real fast. As a matter of fact, you remind me a lot of myself when I was your age. In fact, you're doing so good. I got this here special assignment I've been planning to handle myself, 'cause it's kind of touchy, see? But I decided the other day I'm going to let you handle it. You see, it's like this."
Now, it crossed my mind to correct him on the matter of my few weeks' tenure, but I decided to let it pass when Miss Horklequist entered with a couple of freshly washed water glasses and an evil smirk on her bloated face. I guess Polstead and I got a lot of things discussed over the next couple hours, but the details are kind of cloudy. The long and the short of it is, I did end up with a company car, old Raymond's 47 Chevy, and a $20 expense advance. And with that, I was to tackle my first out-of-town assignment. Polstead described it as a straightforward physical damage claim, or at least it was in its early stages. But the insured had been getting pretty nasty in the last couple of weeks, so it might require some deft handling on my part. Did I feel up to it? Sure. especially if all you're dealing with is some small-town yokel from up there in Quisling, Minnesota.
That was Charlie Warnes reading The Branch Office from Hell. Right from the outset, we're bound to notice that the office portrayed in this story is hardly the nice, neat, professional office your professors at college told you about. But you know what? We're not in college anymore, and factoring in all of our own experiences, we suspect there is probably a good deal of what actually happens in many offices in Charlie Warnes' story tonight. As well, no, sometimes that's just the way things work out. And after you experience characters like Miss Horlequist and Mr. Polstadt, we might have second thoughts about working in a place like that and wondering what being an insurance adjuster is really all about. On the other hand, with jobs scarce nowadays, well, we might just have to make do with whatever we get. Thank you, Charlie Warnes, for a story that we'll not forget for a long time. Friends, the story you've just heard is an excerpt from a novel Charlie Warnes published entitled Arvid Township. In addition, he published a user-friendly workbook for employers entitled Workers' Comp Case Management. Thank you, Charlie Warnes, for your contribution to our show. We hope you'll send us more of your fiction in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Anne DeVigo. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.